Let us open together Chumash Shemos. We move from the Sefer of the Avos to the Sefer of the Jewish people. And the first few psukim of the Parsha are, of course, introductory. And I would like to pay specific attention to psukim Vav and Zayin. And they really mark a transition. Pasuk Vav, Vayomos Yosef v'chol echav v'chol hador hahu. So Yosef, all his brothers, all that generation, so they pass on. Pasuk Zayin, Uvnei Yisrael, Paru v'yishritzu v'yubu v'yatzbu b'me'od me'od. The Jewish people multiply at an incredible rate, that to Maleha Oretz Osam, the land is filled with them. And the next pasuk is the beginning of trouble. Pasuk Ches is already a new king, a new regime, and that's the flow of the psukim. And the Chasam Sofer has a most important comment to make, I believe, about the way that these psukim lead in to each other. Yosef dies, Jewish people increase, there's a new king. One thing seems to happen after the other. But in order to have a more cohesive frame of the sequence, we need to go back to the roots of what our stay in Mitzrayim is all about. And where does it derive from? Well, as we know, the foretelling of Golus Mitzrayim is all the way back in Parshas Lech Lecha, the Bris Ben HaBesorim. Yodoa Teida, Ki Geir Yazarecha Be'eretz Lelahem. And that ultimately was fulfilled in Mitzrayim. We need to know that the closer we look at that posuk, which once again, this is in Bereishis Perek Tesvav, Yodoa Teida, Ki Geir Yazarecha Be'eretz Lelahem, your descendants will be strangers in a land which is not theirs. Va'avodim v'inu osam. They will be enslaved and afflicted. And according to many Meforshim, these experiences do not need to coincide with each other. And moreover, they do not all need to be there in order for the exile to be fulfilled. If there is Geirus, the very fact of being strangers there, and then Avdus, and then Inui, not all of them are necessarily required, certainly, to be there together in order for the clock to start ticking. Rather, it is possible that if only one of them is there, as long as it is fulfilled completely, then that is already Golus time. The very fact that we are strangers in a land which is not ours is already a Golus experience. And moreover, it is possible, therefore, that the majority of the 400 years of the Bris Ben HaBesorim could have passed based on Geir Yazarecha alone. Indeed, not that everyone subscribes to this, but we should know the opinion of Rashi himself, in accounting for the discrepancy of the fact that we were only in Mitzrayim for 210 years, but we were meant to be in Golus for 400 years. According to Rashi, the first 190 years of that Golus took place in Eretz Yisrael. Not the last Golus to take place in Eretz Yisrael. Just coming out of Hanukkah and still in Golus. And if that is the case, no one was afflicted and no one was enslaved in the time of Yitzchak in any meaningful way. And we see, therefore, that through Geirus alone, through Geir Yazarecha, the clock already starts ticking over the Bris Ben HaBesorim. And that's very interesting, because if that's true even in Eretz Yisrael, it could continue to be so in Mitzrayim. And what's most fascinating is, this gives a great deal more atmosphere and appreciation of the words of the brothers. When they come to Paro, the first thing they say is, Lagur Ba'aretz Banu. Lagur ba'aretz banu. They are stating categorically that our relationship to this land, as it was through the Shvatim, is lagur, we're gerim. And indeed, they settled apart from everyone else. In Eretz Goshen, that's where they wanted to be, that's where Yosef wanted them to be, out of the way, not part of the indigenous Egyptian scenery. And indeed, as long as they stayed that way and related to themselves as gerim be'eretz lo lahem, they continued and in fact lived unmolested. And Chasam Sofer moreover posits that had that perspective on our presence in Egypt endured, then the status quo would have endured, and we could have lived out the entire 400 years, or certainly the vast majority of the 400 years, as gerim, not as avadim, and not as persecuted. So what happened? Pasuk Vav and Pasuk Zayin are not historical introductions. They are conceptual introductions. For if we wish to understand why things changed for the Jewish people, why conditions changed, it's because the Jewish people changed. Pasuk Vav, Vayomas Yosef, V'chol Echav, V'chol Adorahu, Yosef, his brother, that whole generation died out. That whole way of looking at things, that perspective that they had on themselves when they first came to Eretz Mitzrayim, Lagur Ba'aretz Banu, that was gone. And the new generation was less inclined to see themselves as gerim. For rather, Pasuk Zayin, in addition to marking the supernatural increase of the Jewish people, that's the first part, Bnei Yisrael, Paru, Vayishratu, Vayibu, Vayasbu, B'ma'od, Ma'od, which is all well and good, but the question is, then what? Vatimalei ha'aretz osam. Vatimalei ha'aretz osam, the land was filled with them, represents a certain push on the part of the new and expanded Jewish people not to stay in Goshen anymore, but rather to spread their wings, to try out new neighborhoods, maybe to become more part of what was going on in Egypt, because the old worldview isn't there to that degree anymore. As soon as that has happened, when the Jewish people stop relating to themselves as gerim, so the gerus phase of the Bris Ben Habesharim has finished, and that itself brings about Melech Chadash, new rules, because that actually marks a transition from Ger Yezarecha to Avodim V'inu Osa. I must mention something which has really struck me. I saw in the writings of Rameir Shapira of Lublin, one of the edicts that we have in the beginning of the parsha is in Pasuk Kaf Beis, Perik Aleph Pasuk Kaf Beis. Vayitzav paro lechol amo lemor, kol haben hayilod hayor tashlichu v'chalabas techayun. Every male to be thrown into the Nile. And indeed, the pasuk does not distinguish. He commands everyone, and it's about everyone. Vayitzav paro lechol amo, and kol haben hayilod. The simple translation of the words is any child, regardless of nationality, and indeed there are some who explain that way for a certain time. It was all the children, just to be sure. How interesting it is that Unkelus translates on the word kol haben hayilod, any child that's born, kol bara diyisyalid leyehudoi, any child that is born to Yisrael. That's interesting, says Rameir Shapira. We assume that first and foremost, Unkelus is a targum, he's a translation. The translation of a child is, a ben is ben. The pasuk didn't say Yisrael, but Unkelus says Yehudoi. So how can you translate something that isn't there? The response of Rameir Shapira is so bitter, and it contains within it the persecution of untold numbers of years. It says Rameir Shapira, every gezeira has a targum. Every legal edict has a translation for those who know what it means. And it could be that Paro, as a memshala, is not able to formally target a certain nation in such a drastic way. And therefore the words of the edict will be everyone, but that edict comes with a targum. And anyone who reads it hears the targum. And the targum is Kol HaBen HaYelod LeYehudoi. And that is something that has ensued throughout the ages. And the people that Rav Meir Shapira represented were no strangers to such targumim. So this is the beginning. There is no avoiding it. The beginning of Sefer Shemos is a parsha of Golos. It is the root of Golos. And within this Golos, let us turn to something much brighter, and that's the beginning of Perek Beis. The birth of Moshe, and Moshe is already the light that will bring the Geula. Perek Beis, Pasuk Aleph. Vayelech ish mi beis Levi, vayikach es bas Levi. That's Amram and bas Levi, literally the daughter of Levi, that's Yocheved. And there is a fascinating background to this marriage, really, between Amram and Yocheved, because the next thing that happens is that she has a child, but the child is her third child. That means she's already had Miriam and Aaron some years back. Chazal tell us in the Gemara in Sota, Daf Yud Beis, that this was the second marriage between Amram and Yocheved, because when Paro set forth the edict with its targum of Kol HaBen HaYelod, so Amram said, so why are we bringing children to the world? A male child will be killed by the Egyptians. So he separated from his wife. And he was the head of the Beis Din. So a person like that does not, his actions do not go unnoticed. So he separated, and all of Levi separated. And that's how they remained until Miriam got involved, his daughter, who was 6 years old at the time. And she said, she gave him Musar. She said, what you're doing is worse than Paro. It's quite a thing to say. Paro's edict is against the males. You're not allowing for the entry into the world, not of males and not of females. Paro, he'll succeed, but if you're not married, so that, then he certainly has succeeded. And if they never enter this world, how can they ever enter Olam Haba? It's quite a thing to say. And Amram listened to her. She got remarried. And the result was Moshe. That's why Miriam has such a special connection to Moshe. Because when Moshe has to be set on the Nile, so Amram is looking to Miriam to say, no, you told me to get remarried, and look what's happening, our child is headed down the river. So Miriam is keeping a watch out for him. L'deya maya osalo. What will become of him? She is practically responsible for his birth. As we know, there are two stages to Jewish marriage. There's what's called kiddushin and nisuin. And kiddushin, of course, is when the chosan gives something, typically a ring, to the kala. And the Nisuin is more the Sheva Brochas and being together as the Sheva Brochas under the Chuppah, together as man and wife. There is almost no distinction between them, halachically. From the time of Kiddushin already, they are already married in practically all respects. And there are just a number of lingering elements that until they're fully, fully married through Nisuin, and that's Kiddushin and Nisuin. Kiddushin comes first. In fact, we normally put them too close together that they need to be prized apart, because we have both of them together under the chuppah, first the kiddushin, then the nisuin, and you need to put something in the middle. That's how the reading of the ksuba became part of the chuppah ceremony, just to prize apart the kiddushin from the nisuin. But strictly speaking, the two do not need to be together at all, not on the same day. Typically, in the times of the Gemara and before, there was a period of months even, where they first consolidated the relationship with Kiddushin. The wedding was sometimes not for a year, in order for everyone to get ready, and etc. What's most interesting is, and this we all know, that the Kiddushin always comes before the Nisuin. Kiddushin always comes before the Chuppah. But when we speak about them, in our bracha, we mention the Chuppah first. Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekadesh Amo Yisrael, Ayidei Chuppah V'Kiddushin. Now, this rarely is a discussion that takes place under the Chuppah, because there are many other discussions taking place under the Chuppah, but the Kiddushin comes first. But we talk about Chuppah first. It should be Mekadesh Amo Yisrael, Ayidei Kiddushin V'Chuppah. And even though that sounds a little bit strange, that just underscores the question. Why is it not like that? So it's very interesting to note that one of the early Rishonim has already addressed this question, and he is the Baal HaItur. And the Baal HaItur said that the question is actually based on a mistake, because when we hear the words Ayidei Chuppah V'Kiddushin, so Chuppah and Kiddushin, that doesn't seem right, because it's Kiddushin and Chuppah, it seems to be reversed. Says the Baal HaItur, it's a mistake, because when you hear it, it sounds to you like it's Chuppah V'Kiddushin with a Vav, Chuppah and Kiddushin, Chuppah is subsequently Kiddushin. But not so, says the Baal HaItur. The correct Nusach of the Bracha, Chuppah V'Kiddushin with a Vase, right? Chuppah V'Kiddushin. And the meaning of the base is through, like Ivdu Es Hashem B'Simcha. The meaning of Chuppah V'Kiddushin means Chuppah via Kiddushin. The only acceptable Chuppah is one that's been preceded by Kiddushin, and therefore Chuppah V'Kiddushin with a vase. Now this could cause a scandal in the printing industry, but these are the words of the Baal HaItur. For me, and this is the minhag of the Sfardim, as is recorded there. For me, it was a chiddush, because I learned for a while in a Sfardi kolel, and I had ample opportunity to hear them speak Hebrew. And with us in the kolel, a vav didn't sound at all like a vase, because a vase sounded like a V, but a vav sounded more like a W, actually. A wah is a vav. So I found it very curious that Sfardim, of all people, could get mixed up between a vase and a vav, because a vase sounds like a V. A vav wouldn't sound like that at all. Chuppah V'Kiddushin, how could they be confused? So I cornered one of my erstwhile colleagues in the kolel during a break, and I asked him, could you explain this to me? How does Sfardim pronounce the vav? So he asked me, which type of Sfardim are you talking about? So I said to him, what do you mean? Well, he said, well, do you mean Persian Sfardim, or Syrian Sfardim, or Moroccan Sfardim, or Egyptian Sfardim, or Iranian Sfardim, or... So I said, okay, forget it. But there's a different minhagim, of course, in my Ashkenazi boorishness, my urban ignorance. I didn't realize that when you say Sfardim, you're talking about half of the Jewish population, and there's 20 different types. And they're hardly likely to be united on this question. Certainly enough of them would pronounce indeed a vav like a V. And indeed, Rabbeinu Bachi himself in Parshas Vayera that we saw all those years ago, when he talks about the comments and the patach, and how important it is to distinguish between them in how you pronounce them. And of course, nowadays, the Sfardim that we know, they pronounce a patach and the comments the same. Rabbeinu Bachi was known as Hadayan HaSfaradi, right from Sfarad. And where he came from, they differentiated between them. So the moral of the story is, thou shalt not make generalizations. But in any case, that's the classic answer of the Baal HaItur, Chuppah V'Kiddushin with a vase. But there is another approach which is actually very fascinating. And it begins with the statement of the Rambam. The Rambam tracks for us in a most fascinating way the introduction, or the entry of mitzvahs into this world. And by that, he refers to the way that the world went from having no mitzvahs to having 613 mitzvahs. It did not happen overnight. Some of the distinctions, of course, we ourselves are aware of. We know that first there were seven mitzvahs, sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach, and then there was the jump. But how does it go? So these are the words of the Rambam in the ninth parak of Hilchas Melachim. This is almost at the end of Mishneh Torah. And the Rambam says, Al shisha devarim nitzava Adam harisha. So Adam himself was commanded with regards to six mitzvahs: avodah zarah, gilui aris, and shpichas damim, and others, gezel, dinim. So what's interesting is we know the original seven mitzvahs as the sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach. But what's important to realize is that six of those seven were given from the beginning to Adam himself. The reason why they're called sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach is because they weren't seven until Noach came. Because it wasn't until Noach that the mitzvah of Eivir min Hachai came in, because prior to that, Adam wasn't allowed to eat anything living, any animal. And therefore, Hosif l'Noach Eivir min Hachai, Nimtzu'u Sheva mitzvahs. And therefore, the cumulative total of mitzvahs of Noach added from 6 to 7, now they are the Sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach. Says Rambam, V'chein haya hadavar b'chol ha'olam. And that's how it was. Ad Avraham. Until Avram. When Avram came, he added, raised the number to 8. Bo Avram v'nitztave yesol elu. He has the additional mitzvah of Mila. That's another mitzvah of Tayag that came in. So it is slowly, slowly progressing. Rambam also says, who is Balal Shachris? That's a question as to how that fits in terms of the introduction of mitzvahs, but that's Tfilos Ovis Tiknum. What about Yitzchak? The Yitzchak Hifrish Maaser. Yitzchak was the first one to take Maaser. He introduced the mitzvah of Maaser. That's the Me'ah Sha'arim, the calculation with regards to Maasros. Yaakov Hosif Gid Hanoshe. Vizpala Arvis. Yitzchak Mincha Yaakov Arvis. Okay, so far, actually the number by the time we finish the Avos has gone up to 10. We don't have a formal name for that group of mitzvahs. They're not the Sheva Mitzvah Noach anymore. There's 10 of them. Says Rambam now, very mysterious words. Uve Mitzrayim Nitztava Amram B'mitzvos Yaseiros. And in Egypt, Amram got further mitzvahs. Ad Sheba Moshe Rabbeinu B'nishlama Torah Ayanu. Moshe came and then it was 613. It's very interesting that in terms of the links of this, in this chain of the progression, without a doubt, the most intriguing one is Amram. Because there is no mention overtly in the Torah of any mitzvahs that he added. And this is a question that has attracted the attention of the Mefarshim. Number one, how do we know that? Where is there an indication that Amram was also brought mitzvahs into the world, mitzvahs of the Torah? And secondly, if we may ask, which mitzvahs were they? It's so opaque in the Rambam. With each of those individuals, the Rambam told you what they added. Avram, Mila, Yitzchak, Maaser, Yaakov, Gid Hanoshe, Amram, mitzvahs. What were they? So the answer, in answer of the first question, which is, where do we see an indication that Amram is part of this select group? It really is a select group, three or four people of pre-Matan Torah who is instrumental in bringing mitzvahs of the world. Where do we see that? It says Meshech Chochma, the reference is in the beginning of Perek Gimel of Parshas Shemos. Perek Gimel. So here is Moshe. It's the burning bush, the Mare Hasneh. And Pasuk Vav. So Moshe has seen the fire. He's approached. Hashem has called out to him, Moshe, Moshe. Pasuk Vav. Vayomer. Anochi Elokei Avicha, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Now says the Meshech Chochma, we need to appreciate that the phraseology here is rather unique, because we actually have it as a matter of principle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu never connects his name to an individual. Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu miyachid shemo ala yachid. It's rare that we have that. But of course, we do find the Elokei Avraham, Yitzchak, v'Yaakov, and perhaps that's because they, as we mentioned in the past, they represented the whole of the Jewish people. And together with them, we have a quartet here. Because Hashem introduced himself as Elokei Avicha, the God of your father, Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Says Meshech Chochma, there is actually no one else in the Chumash that Hashem is referred to as being Elokei, that individual. What would mark Amram and give him a distinction to allow him to be part of the group whose membership is shared by Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Says Meshech Chochma, this is the makor for the Rambam, that Amram was also instrumental in bringing mitzvahs into the world. And therefore, the mitzvahs that are ultimately part of the body of Torah living for the Jewish people, Amram is part of that, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls himself Elokei Avicha in the same sentence as Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. It's a very sensitive vision of the Meshech Chochma. So he's in. But now the question is, well, which are the mitzvahs Yoseiros? Says Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, a most fascinating response. Let's go back to Amram's wedding with Yocheved. What does the Gemara say? In Sota, Daf Yud Beis, Amram listened to his daughter. Amad v'hichzer es ishto. He took his wife back. Vayikach, yeah, she'osa lo ma'ase likuchin. He performed with Yocheved an act of marriage. Hoshiva ba'apirium. He placed her ba'apirium under a canopy. The Aaron u'Miriam meraktim lefaneha. Aaron and Miriam, an unusual turn of events, are dancing there at their parents' wedding. Malachi Asharis Omrim Ema Banim Samecha. Says Reb Chaim, Hoshiva ba'apirion is a very specific expression. Apirion is a canopy. That's the chuppah. Of the mitzvahs, now that we can see from the Talmud that Amram brought into the world of the Torah, is the mitzvah of chuppah, the mitzvah of nisuin, the mitzvah of getting married. That's the mitzvah Yoseiros. And in fact, commenting on this pasuk, contemporary of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rogatchov Gaon in the Tzofnas Paneach, who always is following the Rambam in everything, he has one eye on the Chumash and one eye on the Rambam, when he sees this pasuk, says the Rogatchov, look at Sota Yud Beis, look at the Rambam Hilchos Malachim, that's the mitzvah, that's Amram, mitzvah Yoseiros. So that's a corroboration of Reb Chaim. But the P.S., of Reb Chaim is something unbelievable. And that is, the pasuk tells us that Amram, he took his wife and he led her to the canopy. That's the mitzvah of chuppah. And chuppah is a din Torah, nisuin is a din Torah. There is no mention of kiddushin. Apparently, for whatever reason, the element of nisuin, stage two, was introduced into the world before the element of kiddushin. In his time, it took place entirely of nisuin. The chuppah entered the consciousness of the Jewish people prior to kiddushin. And that, says Reb Chaim, is the reason why, from that time on, from the time of the set nusach of the bracha, we always mention chuppah before kiddushin. Mekadesh Amo Yisrael Ayde Chuppah B'Kiddushin. Kiddushin comes first, but Chuppah happened first. It is to mark the fact that Chuppah entered the world before Kiddushin. From that time on, regardless of the Seder that we do it, of course Kiddushin comes first, but it becomes enshrined in the Nusach of the Bracha Ayde Chuppah B'Kiddushin. That's a Chiddush. That's a rare combination of Rambam, Gemara, Siddur, Chumash, and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik puts it all together. Okay.
Can you have a chuppah without kiddushin?
No. But, I mean, the simple answer is no. Because the chuppah can't really happen. You can't have stage two before stage one, meaningfully. Ironically, we enter the chuppah before kiddushin. You enter the chuppah before kiddushin. But if you left before kiddushin, the chuppah wouldn't have helped you much. That's the simple answer. For a more complicated answer, we'll talk later. I'd like to mention, again, something really, one great Rav Soloveitchik deserves another. In Perek Beis, we have Moshe grows up. And he goes out, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vahi Bayomim Ahim, Vaygdal Moshe, Vayetze El Echav. He goes out to his brothers, Vayarisiv Losam, he sees their suffering. Vayar Ish Mitzri, Make Ish Ivri Me Echav. And he sees an Egyptian man hitting a Hebrew man of his brothers. Vayifen Ko Vacho, of course we know the Pasuk, he looks this way, he looks that way. Vayar Ki Ein Ish. And he sees there's no one there. So he kills the Mitzri. Now, Rav Soloveitchik says, it's interesting to note how the terminology has shifted. And again, there's a lot behind this comment. On the one, initially, he says, Vayar Ish Mitzri. But then when he kills him, it says, Vayaches HaMitzri. And what's all the more interesting is, in between, it says, Vayifen ko vacho, Vayar ki ein ish. Now, what is the meaning of Vayar ki ein ish? Well, the simple understanding is that he looks around, he sees there's no one there. Interestingly, no one really explains that way, for the obvious reason that within three or four psukim's time, it will be apparent that there were people there, because Dasan and Aviram said, hey, what, you want us? You're going to kill us like you killed the Mitzri? So apparently, there were people there. He didn't do a very good job of checking that there was no one there. The two people most likely to tell on him, see him. And that's why Ein Ish doesn't mean that. Rashi says Ein Ish means that there was no one worthy to come from this Mitzri, Ein Ish in the future. Rav Soloveitchik says something else. We note, interestingly, that throughout all of the Golios, and this first root Golos is no exception, the Jewish people find themselves very close to the nation at the helm of the world. And they come into close quarters with them, close encounters with them. Egypt, in its time, was on top of the world. And subsequently, whoever takes over, the exile nations are not second-rate nations. They are always at the top. They're at the top of the game. Bavel conquers the world, that's Golus Bavel. Then Paras, then Yavon, Greece, Rome. And the Jews are always very, have a very close encounter with them. And really see them up front. And as Soloveitchik said, there's an important reason for that. And that is, there is a certain notion that resides within the Jewish people, a possibility that perhaps of all the ways that someone could develop into the best person they could be, Torah is perhaps one of them, but by no means the only one. And they're always curious as to what else is flavor of the month in terms of what the world considers to be the way to get on in life and to be successful. Jews always have a very good sense of smell for that. Whatever ism may be, Jews are always queuing up the night before. And therefore, there is a certain bittersweet bracha that comes with Golus, says Rav Soloveitchik, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows the Jewish people to see the nation that is on top of the world for what it is. And sometimes the lesson is a bitter lesson because the Jewish people see how they are treated by that nation in order to disavow them fundamentally from the notion that this is a philosophy that will create a successful human being, or the ultimate human being. And at that point, they're reminded that perhaps HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them the Torah for a reason. There's always a certain complex that the Jewish people have that is their system better than ours? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, here's their system, and run for your life. And that's how it has always been, until our time. So we begin with a very high regard. We're naturally so respectful for the other culture. We always begin by giving the benefit of the doubt and by assuming that they must hold the secret to success and to development until that crumbles on our backs. Says our Soloveitchik, that is what happened with Moshe. I mean, Moshe has no one is closer to the top than Moshe in terms of the the host culture in terms of Egypt. And as far as he has seen what Egypt preaches, and they are the cutting edge. When he sees an Egyptian, says Rav Soloveitchik, he sees an Ish Mitzri. He sees someone who has a credible claim to be Ish, to be the ultimate man, to be the epitome of respectability and success. The Ivri is also an Ish, and now they're in conflict. The Mitzri is an Ish, and the Ivri is an Ish. But that model is shattered, actually, for Moshe on this occasion. Because he sees the Ish Mitzri acting in a way that no self-respecting human being could act. We know the background. He wanted to be with his wife. He sent him out early. He was with her. Then he came back. He found out about it. He's beating him to death. This is conduct that is unthinkable for a refined and developed person. The Mitzri is doing it anyway. And this was Moshe's first exposure to outside the niceties of the palace, what a real Mitzri looks like. What an ostensibly developed Mitzri is capable of. The inhuman behavior. And it was a turning point for Moshe. Vayifen ko vacho, he sees this, he looks at the Mitzri, looks at the Ivri. Vayar ki ein ish. And he came to a paradigm revolution. This is not an Ish. Someone who is capable of beating someone to death who found out that he was with his wife and abusing every human faculty, that's not an Ish. And when he killed him to save the Ivri, he doesn't say he Vayaches Ish Mitzri. He's not an Ish anymore. He's a Mitzri. And he's trying to kill an Ish Ivri. Very interesting that progression of the Pasuk, and of course so much going into it and so much contained within it. Let's move now to Perek Dalet, which we're still in the Mare Hasner, and we talk about, Moshe talks about a certain characteristic of his, namely his speech impediment, Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud. Perek Dalet Pasuk Yud. Vayomer Moshe el Hashem, Bi Hashem, lo ish devar manochi, I'm not a man of words, gam itmo, gam misholsho, gam mi'oz debrachol avdecha. I haven't been recently, not since we spoke, and not in the past. Ki chavad peruch vad loshen anochi, heavy of mouth. So this is interesting. And the way that we understand it is that Moshe, he doesn't speak so well. One should know the Baalei HaPshat, should be noted, the Baalei HaPshat, Rashbam and others, say that when he says he's kvad peh, kvad lashon, it doesn't refer so much to a speech impediment, but he's not able to speak in the polished way that one has to in royal court. His speech is heavy for him, it's not light on his tongue, says Rashbam. I have it underlined here. Eini boki beloshen Mitzrayim, bechituch loshen. I can't speak the crisp Egyptian that one would need to speak to a king. Ki bekatnusi barachti misham. I was so young when I ran away from there. Vato ani ben shmonim. I'm 80 years old. It's been a long time. I'm a bit rusty on court Egyptian. That's Rashbam, Rashi's grandson. Rashi himself, of course, goes with the more commonly held understanding that kvad peh and kvad lashon means he slurs, he stutters, whatever it is. And it's very striking that of all people, the person with the most important message in the world, in the history of the world, can't really say it in a smooth way. What to make of that? This is a question which is addressed by Rishonim, and there's a very interesting answer to be found in the drushes of the Ran. Rabbeinu Nissim has 14 famous drushes of the Rishonim, and the Ran there says that on the contrary, it is bedafka that Moshe, who has to communicate Torah, does not speak in a smooth way. because if he spoke in a smooth way, the contention may arise subsequently that he smooth-talked the Jewish people into receiving the Torah. There are certain people that they are very persuasive, very suave, and they could sell you the moon and the Brooklyn Bridge on the moon twice. In any argument, they can take any position and convince you that they're right, and then they could just switch around to your position and convince you that you were really right in the first place. They can do that indefinitely until one of them gets tired. And it's a certain koach. Some people have a very hypnotic way of speaking, and they could basically convince anyone to do anything. And it's interesting. It's such an ironic approach from the Ran, the greatest of the Rishonim, that it is imperative that Moshe should not speak that way. It's hard for him to speak because the people still follow him. It's because of the message, not the medium. It's because of the content and not the presentation. A very different approach to Moshe and his Kvad Lashon and Kvad Peh is to be found in the Maharal. In the Sefer Gevuras Hashem. Gevuras Hashem is the volume of the Maharal devoted to matters of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Golus Mitzrayim, Yetzias Mitzrayim. And it's developed by Rav Huttner and the Pachad Yitzchak. Rav Huttner, of course, a great devotee of the Maharal. And he begins by referring us to an interesting phenomenon. Within the Yad Chazaka of the Rambam, the 14 volumes of the Rambam, there is a volume which is called Hafla'a. If you look through, you'll see Sefer Hafla'a. If you never opened it up, it's actually difficult to know what it is. What does that mean? What is the Sefer Hafla'a? There's Zra'im, I know what that is. There's Zmanim, I know what Zmanim. I know what Korbanos are, Avoda, Mishpatim, Shoftim. And Hafla'a, what is Hafla'a? Hafla'a, actually, is the volume that encompasses all of the halachas that relate to speech. It's called Hafla'a. And therefore, in the volume of Hafla'a, you will find Hilchos Shavuos, Hilchos Nedarim, Hilchos Nezirus. And in fact, the root of this, we need yet to find out what it means, but the root is in the Torah. For as the introduction to the vow of Nezirus in Parshas Noso, the Torah says, Ish, ish, ki yafli lindor neder lazir, nozir lazir Hashem. So the Torah has actually attached the concept of hafla'a to speech, to making a neder. But still, what does it mean and why is it so? Says the Pachad Yitzchak, the reason why the word hafla'a, and hafla'a really means is like from the word pele. Pele is a wonder. What's the wonder here? Well, the Ramah, in the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch, actually, it must be near Simon Gimel or Dalet, as he is discussing the bracha of Asher Yotzer. So Asher Yotzer, when a person performs their bodily functions, so they make a bracha Asher Yotzer, and the conclusion of the bracha is, Baruch Atah Hashem, Rafecha Basar, Umafli La'asos. And the Ramah again asks the question, Umafli La'asos, where is the Pele, what is it referring to? Says the Ramah, the Pele that is referred to in the end of the bracha is that actually, although a person has just exited the area that he's, the waist has exited the body, but the truth of the matter is, the Pele is that physical food somehow keeps together a person's spiritual component with their physical side. A person needs to eat in order to live. And what that means is that through eating, somehow, there's something within the food that helps allow for the continued connection of a person's body and soul. That's mafli la'asos. From pure physical matter, somehow it provides for the interface between the physical and the spiritual within a person. Now, says the Pachad Yitzchak, that's why dibur is called hafla'a. Because the Targum Unculus, in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu assembled the components of man, and the components of man are, of course, the way the Torah describes it, earth, Ofra Min HaAdamah, and breath from God, which is his soul. Vayipach pa'apov, nishmas chaim, Hashem put a living soul into Adam, vayihi ha'adam lenefesh chaya. And Adam became a living beast, nefesh chaya. That combination, now that he has his soul from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, along with his physical components, put that together, it's called nefesh chaya. And if you look in the Targum of Unkelus, on those words, nefesh chaya, once again, mitargem, Unkelus renders nefesh chaya, the living soul, as ruach memalala, a talking spirit. Ruach memalala, a talking force. And the reason why that's so, says Maharal, is because it is the koach of speech and developed speech in the way that we're talking about, enunciating words and communicating thoughts and ideas, is unique to man, because only man has this unique combination of neshama with guf. And therefore, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts them all together, and the Torah calls that nefesh chaya, the Unkelus says ruach memalala. The uniqueness of the human combination of body and soul is expressed in speech. That's as the Chafetz Chaim is the meaning. Of course, the Chafetz Chaim never tired of speaking about matters of speech, correct speech and avoiding incorrect speech. The pasuk in Tehillim that we say in Pesukei Dezimra on Shabbos morning, Mi ha'isha Chafetz Chaim. The question is not Mi ha'Chafetz Chaim, who desires life? That's if we would translate it approximately, we'd say, who desires life? The pasuk doesn't say who desires life. The pasuk says, who is the ish who desires life? Mi ha'isha Chafetz Chaim, says the Chafetz Chaim, because David HaMelech is telling you that if you appreciate what's to come, Netzor Lashon Chameira, speak correctly, you need to understand that the way that you speak, your status as an ish is at stake. You've compromised and abused the faculty of speech, which represents you as an ish, if you use your speech for improper things. Who is the ish who wishes to be deserving of that title? Let him speak correctly. Says Bachad Yitzhak, and that is why the faculty of speech is called hafla. Because as the Ramah told us, mafli la'asos refers to the connection between body and soul. And that connection is expressed in dibur. So dibur is a verbal expression of the hafla, of the mafli la'asos. And all dibur is now called hafla. In fact, says the Maharal, this is the explanation behind a statement of the Gemara in Maseches Nida that everyone knows, but as far as the Maharal is concerned, is misunderstood. The Gemara tells us in Nida, Daf Lamed Amud Beis, that when the child is yet in the womb, it learns the entire Torah. Mi etneini ki yarche kedem, says Eov. Who would bring me back to those early months when life was simple and he knew the whole Torah? But when the child emerges into the world, Bo Malach, a Malach comes, Vesotra al Piv, and smacks him on the mouth, and then he forgets his Torah. And should you wonder, says Maharal, if he forgot his Torah, so then what did you learn it for in the first place? Right? It sounds like a malach hashena tzricha legufa, the Torah learning that you're doomed to forget. Says Maharal, not so. If you had it, it's easier to get it back. Whenever a person sits down to learn Torah, they need to know that they're reclaiming something. I once tried to use this to my advantage in school. We were meant to have prepared something and then done Chazorah. Of course, I hadn't prepared. But the teacher asked me, is this Chazorah for you now? I said, in a manner of speaking. So the Maharal asked the question. Of course, everyone has to ask the question. The child comes out and he's hit on the mouth. How is being hit on the mouth cause you to forget something? It may cause you to be quiet, which a child never is when he's born. But to be hit on the mouth, how does that then lead you to forget your learning specifically? Says Maharal, we have that question because we're being somewhat oversimplistic in understanding the Gemara. Are we really to understand that this uber, right, this embryo, somehow is a repository of all Torah knowledge? I mean, that's But what does the Gemara mean? Says the Maharal, the Gemara means exactly the opposite. A person learns Torah before he's born because before he's... Which part of the person that learns Torah? The neshama, his soul learns Torah. That's his cognitive faculty, not his body. Before a person is born, their soul is not yet connected to their body, and therefore it is unimpeded by physical existence and has access to the entirety of Torah. Which is interesting. When we picture that Gemara, that before birth, in those 9 months, the child learns Torah, we think of the child inside the womb learning Torah. Says Maharal, no, you need to think outside the womb. You need to think about the neshama, which is not yet connected to the body inside the womb. That's what's learning Torah. And on the contrary, when the child is born, because of the trauma of taking the soul and putting it into the physical body and fusing the two, that's what causes the child to forget his learning. It's the fusion between the two. Says Maharal, that fusion between the two is referred to in their very specialized way by Chazal as tapping him on the mouth. Because the fusion between the body and soul will always be represented by what comes out of the mouth. And therefore, Sotra Al-Piv, tapping him on the mouth, says Maharal, represents the final installation of the faculty that expresses the connection now between body and soul. It's the Makkah Bepatish of the creation of a human being. But once he's fully assembled, he forgets his learning, because his soul no longer exists in that climate where it's unimpeded. It is very much impeded, and the whole process now starts again as a unified entity. That's Pshat in the Gemara. Says Maharal, this will enable us to understand why it is that Moshe, of all people, could not speak properly. Because the one thing we know about Moshe is that the connection between his body and soul was very slight. It was not a firm connection at all. His physical existence was in no way an impediment to the highest levels of Nevuah. When necessary, he was able to go for weeks at a time without eating or drinking lechem or ochalti, maim l'shasisi, because he is fundamentally the nth degree removed from that fusion of body and soul, which compromises the faculties of the soul. But the extent to which that connection isn't fast is the extent to which his speech is not polished, because the koach hadibur represents the fusion between the two, and with Moshe they're not fused. So this is altogether completely different approach to the issue of kvad peh or kvad loshon with regards to Moshe Rabbeinu. Let us conclude by referring to one other matter that Moshe raises. There's the issue of kvad peh, kvad loshon. And in the beginning of Perek Dalet, Moshe says, Vayan Moshe Vayomer, Vehen Leyaminu Li. They won't believe me. That comes out of the blue. I mean, this is after Perek Gimel. It's been going for a while. And Moshe says, they won't believe me. But the Yishmu Bekoli, Ki Yomu Lo Nira Alech Hashem, Masei Hashem, didn't appear to you. So, Hashem says, okay, I'll give you a sign. Vayomer Lav Hashem, Mazeh Biyadecha, Vayomer Mateh. So he has a staff in his hand. Vayom Ashlicheyu Arza, Vayihil Nachash, Vayonas Moshe Mipono. Okay, it became a snake. And Rashi quotes in Chazal, it was a snake. Moshe should not have judged the Jewish people so harshly. Vayim Leyaminu Li, practically tantamount to Lashon Hara. He's shown a snake. Vayom Hashem Moshe Shlach Yodcha. So Hashem says, hold out your hand, ve'echos biznovo, hold it by the tail, ve'ishlach yodo ve'yichazik bo ve'yilamate b'chapo, and took hold of it and it became a staff again in his hand. That's the first sign. The first of three. Now, what is happening here? Moshe says they won't believe me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says here's a sign. Why does Moshe think they won't believe him? Are we to say that the Jewish people are... they don't subscribe to the idea of Geula? Moshe comes and says, salvation is nigh. And the Jewish people say, no, never happened. Why would they think that? Why does Moshe think that the Jewish people won't believe him? The Netziv explains, by the way, before we get to the Netziv, and we've mentioned in the past, important to realize that in hindsight, the Jewish people came out when they did. But the simple understanding is that they have 190 years yet to be in Egypt. Now, we have ways to work it out, right? Chishev es haketz, right? You can make a cheshbon about the ketz, kuf tzadik, the 190 years, make a cheshbon. Rashi is from Yitzhak. The Jewish people didn't have Rashi. They only had Egypt. Which means that in the consciousness of the Jewish people, it's fascinating to consider. They're not anticipating Geula. They're not expecting Geula for another 6 or 7 generations. They are consigned to be a link in the Golos chain. It's amazing, because now when Moshe comes and says, time is up, okay, so of course, that's going to take some, right? Le'a minerly. We have the benefit of hindsight to work it out. But in real time, what's to work out? But says the Netziv, there's something else. And that is that when Moshe says, I saw this in a letter that the Netziv wrote to a colleague of his, and he addresses this question. It's not in the Hamakdavra on the Chumash. And the Netziv explains, Moshe has another problem. Let's say the Jewish people are accepting Geula, let's say. So another deconstructive question. Who is the Goel? For us, there's only one answer. Moshe, that we know, because we know history. But for the Jewish people, important to realize that there's a strong possibility that Moshe was not their natural choice at all. Their intuitive choice for the Goel is Aaron. Aaron is the older brother of Moshe. He's been with them in Golos all this time. He is a Navi. Right? The Navi Yechezkel, the Nebuah of Yechezkel in Mitzrayim was said to Aaron. So someone will say, no, actually it's going to be Moshe. Strange as it sounds to us, the natural question, if you would say that Moshe is the Goel, do you think Moshe should be the Goel? The counter question will be, who's Moshe? He's been gone for 60 years. Many of them have never seen him. So when he comes, and people have to just remember who he is, maybe their grandparents will tell them, oh, that's Moshe. And the younger brother of Aaron, he's the Goel. Says the Netziv, look at Pasuk Aleph again. Vayan Moshe, Vayan Le'aminu, they won't believe me. V'lo Yishmu Bekoli, why not? Why won't they listen? Ki Yomu Lo Nira Eilecha Hashem. They'll find it difficult to believe that Hashem appeared to you. Because Aaron is here. He's our leader. He's our Goel, should there be one. That's his problem. It's good taina. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds with the first of the signs, with the staff that turns into a snake. Says the Netziv, what's most interesting about this sign is if you look at the end of Pasuk Dalet, when Moshe is told to take hold of the tail, Vayishlach Yodo Bechazako Vayilamate Bechapo, becomes a staff in his hand. Ask the Netziv, what is the meaning of the word Bechapo? If he's holding it, then it's in his hand. What is the meaning of Bechapo? Says the Netziv, something else is happening during this sign. Not only is it the transition, we understand, from staff to snake and staff again. So in the staff, it's exactly like it was in the beginning. Says the Netziv, no, it isn't. Because every staff has a top and a bottom. It has the handle, right? And then has the bit that's embedded in the ground. They're not the same. Now, when he throws the staff down and it becomes a snake, so Pashtus tells us that the head of the staff became the head of the snake. And the tail of the bottom of the staff became the tail of the snake. So it is. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, now pick it up again. Pick it up how? Shlach yodcha ve'echoz biznavo. Take hold of its tail. And he did take hold of its tail. And when he took hold of its tail, it became a staff in his hand. That means that there is a new alignment of the staff. What used to be the tail has become the head. And what used to be the head has become the tail. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, l'man ya'amin. That is addressed the issue of lo nirah eilecha Hashem. Because Moshe was the tail and Aaron was the head. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu has decided that the tail should become the head. And that's the first oath. So these are some of the he'aros from within the Parsha. And we'll leave it over there for this evening. Just to mention again, we'll meet again, Mitz Hashem, in 2 weeks' time to consider Parsha's bow. Wish you all the best.